That's big. I never would have done it.
That's right. Yeah, Al and Tony are still playing golf down there in Tampa.
Yeah, they live
in the area.
They play practically every day, I guess. Been close friends for many, many years.
Yep.
Now, when did you first get your first bite about Major League ball?
Well, the Major Leagues was something.
Well, no, I mean, you know,
to be minor
league.
People.
Yeah.
Well, Paul Critchell.
Yeah.
You see, that the connection there was Paul and Joe Press were very close friends, and they see each other quite a bit, and that's how Harry Hess and Bill Skiff all got in with Paul Critchell was through Harry through Joe Press, and of course Harry had played minor league, and of course Bill had played in the majors, been with the Yankees a short while, and finally Critchell came and see, and he said, "Well, we want to sign you," and so he and my dad met together in the old Dykeman Oval.
Oh yes, I remember. Yeah.
And they signed the contract there, and they paid me all of $1,200 to sign.
Well, at least you got something for it, and they must have valued you, or you wouldn't have gotten.
Yeah, well, that's it.
In those days, that was not, insignificant.
No.
And you had good years at Wheeling, Norfolk, and Columbus. Is that the pattern that
it took? The pattern. Well, the Columbus was, I was there optioned on a deal with Pat Malone, went to the Yankees. Ricky made a deal for me because Don Hirst wouldn't report to the Columbus club. He was holding out.
Yeah.
So they got me to play. And I was hitting about 350 something. I broke my leg just sliding in the home plate on a home run inside the park.
Yeah.
And that was in 1935.
Now, did they send you to Wheeling or Norfolk?
Yes, the Yankees sent me to Wheeling. In fact, Paul Critchell took me by the hand. He went down with me in the train and delivered me. And funny, getting off the train, there's a big crowd at the station at Wheeling. Holy cow, big crowd. I said, "Boy, is this the way they welcome the ball players here?" He said, "Well," he sort of mumbled something. So I got off, and then I found out later they were welcoming either the football team or the cheerleading team who had won a state championship or something. So, that sort of brought me here, right?
Brought down to earth.
Right in a hurry, yeah. And another case there was, I remember playing a game there. Jack Sheehan was our manager, and he was still playing a little third base. And we were behind, I guess, 3 or 4 runs one day, and I'm on first base, and I think I see the steal sign. And back then, when you're 3-4 runs behind, you didn't steal. The game wasn't played that way. You didn't try to steal. Take them one base at a time. Not like today. They run any time. It's a whole different ball game. So, I took off at second base, and I'm throwing out from here to the wall. And now I have to go past Sheen, who was coaching at third base, and our dugout was at third base. So as I walked by, he said, "What happened, bud?" I said, "Gee, Mr. Sheen." I said, "I thought." He said, "Wait a minute. Stop right there." He said, "Don't go to thinking you're weak in the ball club." So he taught me a quick lesson.
Well, that's great. Now, let me ask you this. What was your parents' attitude about you playing Major League Ball? Did they encourage
my
you?
Father was a little semi-pro ball player around 60th Street in Amsterdam Avenue. He was a little left-handed pitcher. See, he was left-handed. He was the oldest of his family. I'm the oldest of mine, the only left-hander. And my older daughter is left-handed, so it came down 3 generations. The oldest were all left-handed. But my dad, I saw him pitch a little semi-pro ball right there at 60th Street, so it sort of came along.
Yeah, but in other words, they encouraged you. They were not against your plan.
Yeah,
maybe.
My mother was rather sickly, but she'd take a great interest. She was quite a rooter. In fact, he wouldn't sit with her. He'd get off by himself. He didn't want anybody to know him. But she'd be rooting, and they knew who she was.
Let me ask you this. Did you have any qualms about signing with the Yankees? Admittedly, they were probably the greatest organization in baseball at the time. But you knew that Lou Gehrig was
right.
was the resident.
Our outlook was that there are other clubs. If you produce, you'll play somewhere.
Sure, I could understand that.
In fact, I remember after the season at Columbus, Lou and I were at a charity affair at Dempsey's restaurant, and he said to me, he said, "Hey, geez, I hear you." Pretty good ball player, and he said, they're talking about you taking my job, and I said, I started to laugh. I said, nobody's going to take your job. I said, I'm just looking to try to get into the major league. I said, but your job, no. Nobody's going to be taking it. But he had that way about him. He very gracious.
The interesting thing about Gehrig is that people always think of him as playing ball at the Bakerfield baseball field, but actually he never played up there at the complex at Dyckman. He played when the Columbia University baseball diamond was on the campus
right.
at 116th Street.
Right north, yeah.
And he had a record home run that wound up on the steps of the Butler Library
yeah.
there.
I know, I've worked out. Paul Critchell used to have me work out with the Columbia Club in the fall. What was the coach's name?
The guy from Fordham, Jack.
Not Jack Coffey. Not very fine gentleman.
He was a famous pitcher.
Yes, he was. he pitched in Major League.
Oh,
good. Hey, he had me. Yeah. Paul had me work out with the Columbia Club in the fall.
That's interesting. Do you have any particular memories about your minor league playing days? The guy, you know, the teams you play for, the managers or the ballparks.
Well, of course, in 34, I played for Bill Skiff, who I had played with, semi-pro ball up here, and I could run pretty well, and he had me run, and we won everything, because we had Eddie Sawyer was on that ball club, and we won the playoffs and everything else there. Bobby Stevens was a little shortstop. He was on the ball. He was on his way down.
Are we talking about
Norfolk?
Norfolk, right.
1934. And that's the year I hit 360 there, and I broke the league record for 56 stolen bases, which held up for 20 years until the...
That's interesting, because I never realized that you had that kind of speed.
Yeah.
And
Bill would use it wherever possible, and he was always... he turned out to be such a friend, he was always trying to promote me, so he'd make sure I'd look good. He'd have me doing whatever I could to better myself. And then I was in spring training with the Newark Club in 35. Bob Shorkey was running the Newark Club then. And that's, in fact, my Wheeling, Jimmy, All-American football player, Auburn, Jimmy Hitchcock. Was our third baseman, and he was another fellow from Georgia.
Hitchcock played at Auburn, I think.
He did. Yeah.
And a very good ball player.
Yeah, and then his brother came along and also played. But Jimmy ended up marrying Bob Shorkey's daughter, and he became, I think, the president or the head of the state athletic board. Alabama.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, he died a young man.
How about the ballparks? What were they like? I mean,
well, they were almost like the major league as far as one be long and one to be short, whether it be right field or left field.
Did you play any games at that famous ballpark in Nashville, Sulphur Dell?
No, we had one in Beckley, though. If you hit the ball over the left field fence, it went down 300 feet. Over the fence, it went down straight down 300 feet. The fence was right at the edge of the mountain. They had cut the ballpark out of the mountain. Not too many people got near that left field fence. Nobody tried to catch one up against it.
Beckley, West Virginia.
That's right, Beckley, West Virginia.
Now, let's see, at what time did you get the feel that Brooklyn was interested in you, or was it a complete surprise to you?
It was. Well, a funny thing happened, and I always tell it, the Bear Lewis fight was in the winter of 35, 35-36, by the fall. And I went to the fight. It was in the stadium, and we ended up in the press room after the fight with all the newspaper men, and Colonel Rupert came in, and he introduced me to him, and he had that little accent.
Yeah.
And he says, "Hassett, you went to Manhattan College?" I said, "Yeah." "Yes, Colonel, I did." "Good. You come from New York?" He said, I said, "Yes." He said, "Good, we'll keep you in New York." So as I always said, he did, he saw me to Brooklyn, but yeah. I was still in New York.
Yeah, I didn't, I thought he more or less left most of that to Weissau. And,
well, he did. Yeah. But I mean, he was making conversation.
Yeah. It was interesting. Wade Hoyt used to tell that great story about when he was battling for an increase, and
that's
Rupert said, "What do you think I am, a millionaire?" You know.
You know that whole story. Wade told me the story because we got to be pretty friendly when he was over
with
at Brooklyn.
The Dodgers, yeah.
We New York boys got to stick together.
But
he said that he had all those buildings up on the wall. That's how he got around to that. See, what happened was the colonel was called out of the room. Well, Wade was in there waiting to talk to him about an increase. And he's looking at the pictures of all these buildings. So when the colonel comes back, he says, "Colonel, what are these buildings?" "Yes, Hoyt said, that one, 8 million, and this one cost me 10 million, and that one, 20 million, and then you get talking about the raise," and he said, "What do you think I am, a millionaire?" Which I think is, that's a cute story.
Well, listen, you came to Brooklyn, and I can remember some interesting games that you played in Brooklyn, and of course you can remember a lot more than I can. You must have had some games that particularly stood out in your mind in the course of your 7 years in the majors. Of course, the World Series must have been particularly
important. Well, of course,
important.
Yes, that was.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of your time with Brooklyn, because I remember a couple of games. It must have been outstanding games for you, but you tell me what your...
Well, actually, very few of the games that first year... The only fact was that I was playing, and I great to be playing, and that was all. I was in the major leagues, and boy, I'd feel badly every time we got beat, and we got beat rather often.
Yeah.
So,
that was kind of rough, I mean.
Yeah, but for the Phillies. In fact, my father used to come with friends, and I'd get angry because he had them there, and I didn't want to talk because I was angry at the fact we lost again.
Yeah.
He said, "Yeah, but you got a couple." I said, "Yeah, the hits don't mean nothing. You don't win." So. That was a different era.
I will try to refresh your memory about one particular game which I saw at Baker Bowl. It was early in the season of 1937 when the Dodgers had those uniforms, the green and tan road uniforms. And the Dodgers were losing by one run, and going into the first of the ninth inning with Johnny Hudson on base, Gil Brack hit a ball that Chuck Klein couldn't handle, and Hudson tied the score. And you came to bat about two innings later, extra innings, and one of the few times I saw you really pull a ball hard, you hit it over that fence with two men on base,
and
won the ball game.
It's funny.
That probably doesn't mean anything to you.
It doesn't register at all. It's funny.
I remember another one. You mentioned that you were occasionally called on to play the outfield when Dolph Camilli came to the team in 38. And at that time, I remember you and Camilli, one of you got a triple and one of you got a single against Clay Bryant at a game when Bryant was really throwing aspirin tablets.
Yeah, he could throw them too.
And you won that game in extra innings also. But you had either hit a triple to left center or it was a
probably
single.
Probably wherever I hit the left center.
But that was a game which I remember you being a strong factor in. But now let's get to talking about the managers a little bit.
Well, I was just going to say that 36 season, Wade Hoyt and I, we were in the Edgewater Beach Hotel. It was getting toward the end of the season, and I was hitting about 315, 320 at the time. And as I say, we had another week or two to go, maybe three. Because I know I ran into a slump, but then come back out of it and ended up about 310. But we were in having a beer at the bar in the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago. And Casey, who was our manager at the time, and Edna, his wife, were sitting at a little table. So it came about 11:45, and we had a curfew at 12. So we finished up our beer, and we're heading out. And Casey yelled for me, "Hey, Bud, come here." And he said, "Sit down." So he called the waiter off. He said, "What are you drinking?" I said, "Beer." Oh, he said, "Bring him up here." He said, "Well," he says, "I want you to sit down." He says, "I owe you something." He said, "I got to tell you something." He said, "I owe you beer, or maybe more." He said, "Our organization signed it, and nobody in the organization saw you play." He said, "I took the word of all my friends from the American Association." And he says, "I took their consensus of opinion as to whether you could make it or not." And he said, "You made the deal stand up pretty well, so I owe you a couple of beers."
That's an interesting story.
Yeah. So but I never realized that nobody had seen me play. I know Heinie Groh was one fellow who did see me, and he was scouting to somebody else, but I'm sure that at the Giants, I believe he was. But I know Terry wanted to sign me, and the Yankees weren't going to let me play in New York.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect.
Yeah, he wanted me, and
Now, it's interesting. Nice. It tells you something about the managerial position in the major leagues. If a guy has the talent on his team, he can be a great manager.
Right.
He could also be a great manager without the talent, but the team isn't going to win.
That's simple. Yeah, he knows the game, and there's nothing he can do about it.
You know, yeah.
He just do the best he can, and that's it. Whether this football situation, I was just reading about the Giants here, whether that's another one of those things, I don't know.
But you know, it's funny. Warren Spahn pitched for Stengel with the Boston Braves,
right,
when
yeah.
they were.
Well, he was there. He was an 18-year-old when I was up there.
And he also pitched for Stengel when the Mets came into being at the Polo Grounds. And he always had that comment. He said, "I played for Stengel before and after. He was a genius."
Which I think is great. Very good thinking.
But you know, you have a guy like Bill McKechnie, who was a great manager.
Right.
And he never, outside of the years he had Cincinnati,
yeah,
he
Cincinnati.
Had a similar situation with the Braves.
Incidentally, talking about him, you know, he had all those sinker ball pitches out there.
Yeah.
Bucky Walters had all, and he had a bunch of them. He used to wet the infield from home plate out about 12 feet.
Is that right? This is McKechnie.
Yeah. He'd stop it. And you'd hit the ball on that ground and hit that stuff, and you'd flop, 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 flop.
Hello.
Those are little tricks they used to use. Oh boy.
I got to ask you a couple of questions about the clubhouse atmosphere on those ball clubs. Now, you were at Brooklyn. What was it like there? I just have some of the guys' names that you know, you may want to comment on. You were there at a time, and you had Babe Phelps and Jimmy Booker and Johnny Cooney, guys like that.
Well, Johnny was my first roommate.
He was a fine outfielder.
He was a fine man. Yes, they always forget that he pitched for about 4 or 5 years before he went back down and came back up as an outfielder.
Were you with the team in Chicago when Mungo went berserk and had that ruckus there?
And then he got out of that when he left.
He ruined a set of matched luggage that Booker had, Grimes had been visiting at his farm in New Haven, Missouri, and the hotel hollered for him, and that was quite a mess.
Well, I was with him when he jumped the ball club with Eddie Zeltner.
I remember that.
Yeah, he came back home here. Yeah. And I remember, he said, "There's only one real professional, Johnny Cooney on the ball club." Mungo made the statement.
Yeah.
And Johnny Cooney said to me, he says, "Geez, he thinks this is a country club, only one pro." Golf club, one pro.
He was a fabulous character. You know, he and Paul Richards, when they were rookies at Hartford, they roomed them together because they were both sleepwalkers and they couldn't room them with other guys. And according to the way Richards tells this story, he says one night, he said, Mungo walked into a closet and he woke up and started screaming. He says, and he woke me up. He says, and I found out I was under the bed.
That's cute.
How about
Van was something else. I remember playing one game, and he had a short fuse. He could get mad in a hurry. So they got me playing left field and Crosley Field, and they had that little terrace, too.
Yeah.
And he says, a ball hit in the left center, and I go over, and I start to back up. And, you know, backing into a terrace with the ground going up, the first thing you know, your heels hit the high part, and back over I went on my back, and the ball fell in there. It's about the first inning. Jesus, as soon as the inning was, I ran in, I said, Jesus, man, terribly so. I apologize. I said, you know, I'm a lousy outfielder. I quieted him down before he could get too mad. But that's what you'd have to do with Van.
Well, I heard quite a few stories about him. I was out visiting my son in Washington, and Lonnie Fry lives in Snohomish, Washington.
I wish I'd have known when I was out there. I'd have looked him up because Lonnie and I were very close.
And he was telling me of his early years trying to play at Brooklyn, and of course he was one of Mungo's favorite targets.
I know it.
And oddly enough, Lonnie was not too complimentary about Stengel, and I always thought Stengel doted on him. He said that although he got along with Stengel, he said there were instances where he felt Stengel was very impatient with young ball players. He named one guy in particular, Frank Scaff.
And
he gave Scaff a very hard time, you know.
Well, I think Scaff and Geraghty, Ben Geraghty, came up together. They both played at Villanova. I think what he was trying to do, he thought Frankie was a quiet fella, and he thought maybe he'd give him some hustle.
No, I just wondered about
that. You know, talking about the Mungo, my first game, opening day, 1936. That thing with Fry and Bartel.
Oh, no, they were rolling down the first baseline. I remember that,
And I was involved. I was the first baseman.
Yeah.
And Bartel bunted after Mungo knocked him down.
Yeah.
And the ball's bunted. He's trying to bunt and then come over and cut him.
Yeah.
And luckily, the ball's bunted a little hard and a little over toward the line, so I knew what was happening.
Yeah.
So I grabbed the ball and made the play myself rather than...
Of course.
I run across the bag, and now I turn around, and 10, 15 feet beyond the bag, Bartel's laying on the ground. Mungo tripped him, and now he's diving after him. I go over and try to get in, and next thing I know, I got Bartel under me. Luckily, I had both hands out on the ground.
Yeah.
And I say, hey, Dick, stay here.
Yeah.
And our boys are pulling Mungo away,
yeah.
And all the Giants are around me, and she said they could have Sundayed me to death, except they could see I wasn't trying to punch him.
Right.
I was just laying there. But I nothing but white uniforms around me. I figured I'm going to get it. But this is my opening day in the major league.
Well, that's really something.
I didn't know what, right in a hurry.
well, Mungo, I can remember DeRocher getting into a fight with Zeke Venura. Of course, Venura was not a fighter, and...
He was
a clumsy guy at first base, and DeRocher caught him, and they fought, and Mungo came out of the dugout carrying a bat, and the umpire grabbed the bat. I think it was, I don't know if it was Beans Reardon or not, but that was another episode of which Mungo was a part. Another guy I saw who was a teammate of yours, I want to be sure this tape is still running, was Tom Winsett. I saw him in
McKenzie,
Tennessee.
Tom Winsett,
And he is selling real estate. He's living in West Palm Beach now.
Is he?
Yeah. But we had about an hour and a half together, and he was telling me, he said, I can't tell you why I wasn't a better ball player as a major leaguer. He said, the ball looked like a grapefruit in the minor leagues. He said, I could get up. He said, I did have one important hit, he remembered. He said when Hubble was going for that, it was at the Polo Grounds on a holiday weekend. And
I remember he hit one
home run. He said that at that time he hit a triple or something with the bases loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit a couple of, you know, he did hit some home runs for the Dodgers. But that was a real surprise that he was.
I had played with him at Columbus.
Yeah.
We had him and Nick Cullip in the same outfield.
Oh, really, yes.
We had a pretty good ball club. Yeah. And we had some great pitchers. Klinger, Bob Klinger, Cooper.
Right. And Walt Cooper was some kind of pitcher.
We had what the heck was his name? Was a catcher, pitcher, coach and everything else.
Oh,
Polish name.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Oh, Ryba. R-Y-B-A, yeah.
Reba.
Yeah,
Mike
Reba.
And then we had a couple others that made the major league.
Well, you had Bordegray. He was another character.
He showed up with the goatee and a mustache.
Yeah, he...
36. It's the first time I ever saw any guy with a goatee.
There's a great story about him when George Earnshaw joined the club.
Right.
Earnshaw was pitching, and in a game, he was winning by one run. Bordegray made a terrible error. I think I've got the story wrong. He was leading by several runs, and Vortigray dropped a very easy fly ball and allowed two or three runs to come in, so that the margin was just,
right,
you know, one
short
run.
Yeah.
And then at the next inning, the last turn at bat for the other team, some guy hit a ball that looked like it was going to be a triple off the right center field fence at Ebbets Field, and Vortigray climbed halfway up the fence and caught it with a fantastic catch. And as he was coming off the field, he had saved the game for Earnshaw. Stengel said to Earnshaw, he said, "Tell you what, George," he says, "I'm going to hold him, and you can bite him on the leg."
I can just see that, too.
Tell me about Burley Grimes.
Well, we seem to have problems. Burley and I never seem to hit it off. And he pulled me out of a game. We were playing the Cubs one day. Man on first and second, and we were in the Cubs are at bat. And it's a bunting order. I came in to charge for the punch. They punted the ball to me, and I reached to make the play for the ball. I was going to go to third base with the ball because I had the time to throw him out. And as I reached, I looked and dropped the ball, and everybody saved. Well, he stopped the game there, brought Cooney in, took me right off first base, and sent me in. So 12 years later, 1949, that was 37. 49, he's working for the Yankees, and I had just finished managing Newark for the Yankees, so we were at the Yankee Victory Dinner, and he called me over in the corner and apologized for that.
That's nice.
Yeah, it totally took him 12 years to get around. Finally made it.
Woody English was mad at him for bringing him to Brooklyn. He liked Woody.
Yeah.
And he wanted him to play for him.
Yeah, I know.
I
found out later through his first wife that we had religious differences, and I didn't know where he got them, but those things I'd rather not get
into. No, there's no need to. He had an interesting observation. He was assigned, at the time that he lost his job with Brooklyn as manager, a man who was an executive at the Brooklyn Trust Company was a factor in Grimes being fired. Now, that seems odd, but the Brooklyn Trust Company...
McLaughlin.
There was a lot of money outstanding.
McLaughlin was a fellow, as I remember the name.
But according to Grimes, he said, this particular guy, I don't think it was McLaughlin, this particular fellow was at Princeton University, and I was sent down there to scout a ball player. And this was the ball player, he said. And he said, I turned him down. He said, so it took him a while to get back at me.
Well,
but that's just an interesting story.
That's a good story.
Woody English told a great story about Tuck Steinbeck. Steinbeck came up with the Cubs.
Right.
And in the 1932 World Series, the Yankees and the Cubs were really going at it because of Mark Koenig's small share that the Cubs voted.
Right, I remember, yeah.
And the language was something, even the... commissioner said, I learned words, Landis said, I learned words I never heard before. And he said, I think I've heard plenty of them. So, but the interesting thing was is that Steinbeck got thrown off the Cup bench by the umpire for using some of that language. He said, and this is what English talking, he said, Steinbeck wouldn't say God if he was in church. he said he was a, you know, typical
right.
clean-cut
Oh, you
were
very much so, yeah.
And handsome guy, and
beautiful.
He dressed well, and...
His brother-in-law was Wayne King.
Yes, I know. He
yeah.
married
yeah.
Alice, I forget her name. Yeah. But
Tuck and I were very close, and of course he was over with the Yankees with me, too, so...
There's a guy who had plenty of talent. I always thought that he should have done better in the major leagues than he did.
You know, he had the greatest arm, and he threw like a girl. It was the funniest thing. He'd make a funny throw, but geez, that a boy would carry.
But he was, you know, he had speed.
Yeah, he could do it all.
He could do everything, and he'd occasionally get you the long ball, and he came up as a golden boy after the Cubs, somehow or other, it just never worked. Any of these other guys?
I think he got 14 years in, though, so I guess he's hung around for quite
he's living out in Sherman Oaks, so he's not too well. He's married again. I don't know what
is
happened.
Is that right?
To you.
Yeah.
Well,
he worked for Brooklyn for quite a while, I think, in the Dodgers.
Yes, he was in group sales.
Group sales,
as
I remember, yeah.
Joe Stripp.
Jersey Joe Stripp. Joe was quite a character.
He had all his teeth pulled because he had a bad arm, you remember?
His theory was, play 100 games, and the other 50 I'll tack on the end of my career.
You know
that's the way he left. We used to call him Johnson & Johnson. He always had something wrong with him.
The funny part of it was, is that Joe's...
And he was a hell of a ball player.
I thought he was a fine ball player.
He was a good ball player.